Thanks very much. Dr. Raven, go ahead, please.
Hi, everybody. My name is Raven. I'm an addict, and I live in Witt Springs, Arkansas. I fondly refer to it as bumfuck. Ken asked me to speak, I don't know, a week or so ago, and I agreed. So here I am, coming to you from the holler. That's my front yard. Those are some of my horses. I guess I'll start with a little bit about where I came from and how it went. I'm from upstate New York originally. I was born in Poughkeepsie, New York. There coincidentally is a Poughkeepsie, Arkansas, spelled the same way, which is kind of strange. Anyways, I'm 62, so I was born in 1963. And we moved around a little bit. We moved to California and back, and my dad died in a car accident when I was 10, 1973. He was a surveyor and he was working across the street from the Twin Towers when they were being built and was commuting with a buddy, dropped his buddy off. We lived about 100 miles north of the city and he fell asleep. And that changed everything for me. And I know looking back that, and I've known for a long time, that that was the start of me coping behaviorally in addictive ways. I can remember after he had the accident, my mom, here's my mom having to tell her three kids their dad died. They were never going to see their father again. I had a brother that was 8, one that was 12. And I remember walking, she sent me to the neighbors for something. Well, we lived rurally then. So I'm like trotting through the woods, a couple acres over to the neighbor. And we'd gone to church a handful of times, I remember. I fucking hated it. You know, my mother dressed me in like girly stuff, and I'm not that person. So, anyways, I was like, all right, this would be it. This would be it. So I was like putting all my eggs in one basket. I said, all right, if you're the loving, caring God you're supposed to be, then you won't let my father die. And I was like, that was it. I washed my hands of it. Well, of course, he died. And that he was my world. I mean, what 10-year-old, you know, we're not equipped to lose a parent. It's an out of sequence loss, just like a parent losing a child. And we're not a death embracing society or a death denial kind of culture where we don't talk about it. We skirt around it, you know, we say things and we're it's awkward. And but that set me up for my using. I know it did, because I just didn't care about anything or anybody after that. I had a big chip on my shoulder. Actually, I had one on both shoulders. So it was like I kind of went through life daring people to knock them off. And even though I wasn't a violent person, the things that came out of my mouth made you think I was going to kill you. So I learned these defense mechanisms really early on how to not deal with people and not deal with the grief or the trauma. You know, and you think about it, it's like I think there's a lot more societally, there's a lot more supports in place for kids. You know, you think about all these fucking school shootings and, you know, how do we support kids around that? And there was nothing back then. And I'm sure in a lot of places there's not much either. And that's just what we go through. And so I kind of had to figure out things on my own. My mom remarried less than a year later. We went, she, oh, our culvert went out. We had a little bridge that went over this little stream down by the road and it got washed out. And the guy that ended up coming to do the work, because the person she contacted couldn't do it or whatever, I don't remember. But so that's how she met my stepfather. And he was an alcoholic and he had. He was divorced and had four of his own boys and one sort of foster son. And he was an alcoholic, if I didn't mention that already. And he was pretty abusive, verbally, physically. I remember getting the shit beat out of me going to school one day. I don't know. I think I got my period and I played the trumpet. And this was back before tampon days, okay? These sanitary belts that held the maxi pads, you know, this big wad between your legs that it's like archaic kind of stuff. And I was going to school and my mom was like, "Why don't you carry the purse?" And I'm like, she's like, "What do you do with your pads?" I'm like, "I put them in my trumpet case." Well, I came home from school one day and I guess they wanted to force me to carry them in a purse. So I got on this knockdown drag out fight with my stepfather and he beat the living shit out of me, threw me all over the room. I was black and blue all over my body. And I went to school the next day, put that fucking purse in my locker, never looked at it again. But I went right down to the nurse's office and I turned his ass in for child abuse. I can remember, like, years later, as an adult in my 20s, going to visit. And so I lived about 3 hours away from them at that point. And they would joke. They would still joke about it. "Remember when you turned Willie in for child abuse?" I'm like, "Yeah, because he beat the fucking living shit out of me." And anyways, I started having sex at a young age, and very indicative things, you know, developmentally. You think about, like, what kids go through, what young girls go through, and we start to in puberty look for attention outside of ourselves. And how do we find that, you know? Well, through boys, through physical contact, through sexual contact. And so that kind of took me down another different road. But it was my step couple of my stepbrothers, they were having sex with me. And even though it seemed consensual at the time, you look back and it was like not appropriate. And as a kid, you know, you want to be, or at least fit in or be the cool kid. And that was some of the things that I did. But a couple of them were very much older than me, and I know that it was fucked up. And so that kind of shapes who you are. I started running away from home because they would fight like cats and dogs. And it was like, ah, oh, man. You know, so I learned, like, from a young age to rip and run. And that's what I did. And that's how I did it, was physically. And my mom dragged me off to psychiatrists. Normal kids don't run away from home. And you're getting all these beliefs and values instilled in myself about, you know, I'm worthless, I'm no good, I'm defective. And, you know, looking back as an adult, I've got more perspective and education on it. And the question to ask is, why does a kid doesn't run away from a normal home, okay? But, you know, they couldn't understand their part in anything. And I ended up being like a mediator between my mom and my stepdad for a long time. Well, I got kicked out of the ninth grade, sent away. I had stole Valium from my mother that I found and was selling pot at that time, buying it from a seventh grader. I was in ninth grade. And anyways, I'd saved up some money somehow and, you know, buy some weed, roll up joints, and I'd sell it. And well, I got called into the principal's office one day. I was signing in late. I would tell my teachers I had trumpet lessons, and one of them called me on it one day, the math teacher. And they called me down to the office after I came in, I don't know, second or third period, all stoned late. And got in it almost in a knockdown drag out with the vice principal. He's trying to rip the purse away from me or whatever I had with the pot in it. And I got the state police came, I got taken away from school, and nobody ever saw me again. So once in a while, I wonder, like, what people think, you know, what ever happened to so and so, you know what I mean? If it even crosses their minds or whatever. But so I got hooked up in the juvenile justice system, and I was sort of like the model resident. And then from time to time, when nobody was watching me because I was the model resident, I would just waltz off and go AWOL for a month or two at a time and hitchhike around the country. And you can just imagine what happens when that's going on. Nothing good. And so there was a lot of sexual assault in my history, rape, sexual abuse. And those things really took their toll. You know, you learn how to bury that stuff. You bury it deep and you bury it hard and you don't want to look at it again. And but when we bury things, we bury them alive. They come back up and they come back and they eat away at you until, you know, we get therapy or we do some get some kind of help where we can process the emotions that are attached to that and some of the behaviors that are attached to that as well. When I finally got discharged years later, I was locked up for about 15 months. Oh yeah, here's the judge. Calls me incorrigible, and You're never going to amount to anything. You know, lock her up. Undetermined amount of time, not to exceed 18 months. What the fuck does a 15-year-old kid do with that, you know? We do what we do. And so that was my life for a while. And, you know, it wasn't fun, and it was very isolating and alienating, and not being home at holidays, not having a family, not having a sense of what the fuck is a family even. And just basically feeling abandoned by everybody in my life that was supposed to mean something to me. And so when I got out, I ended up taking got my GED, and I finished my first semester at community college before my high school class graduated. And then I went for a few more semesters, and then I dropped out. Reagan was in administration then; he was the president, and he was cutting out. I was getting Social Security benefits. It was like a big whoop, about $450 a month. But things were a lot cheaper back then, so yeah, I made do. And I met my first husband hitchhiking, going out to party one night with a friend of mine, and I was living with him. And you know, sex and drugs brought us together. Well, that doesn't la you know that doesn't make for a lasting relationship. And so Reagan was cutting out the benefits for survivors. You know, get the Social Security survivor benefits from my dad dying if I was in college. You know, once I was 18, my mom didn't get them anymore. All I wanted to do was party, so that's what I did. And so it took me 10 years to put a 2-year education together, and I did that. But when I was 25, I was really hitting a bottom. I was doing a lot of physical activity. I got into a lot of bike riding, weight training. I was did some competitive bodybuilding shows, and was really kind of focused on like looking good on the outside, right? We can't make the insides feel good by making the outsides look good. And that was something that was brought to my attention when I went to treatment. I went to treatment the first time when I was 25, when my first ex-husband said, you better get help or else. I went, it failed. I had like a really bad psychotic episode, was hospitalized, came home. And then I don't know, a couple months later, because I went back to doing the crank. We call that meth now, but we called it crank speed, you know, snorted. But I kind of kept on that path, and I was at the point where I wanted to stop. I couldn't stop, and I felt like, you know, I couldn't go on anymore. Like that was my rock bottom. I had a rock bottom a year ago, but it wasn't like that. It was, but it was different because a lot of time went by between then and now. And so I went back, and the first ex-husband said to me, well, what am I supposed to do? I'm like, I don't give a fuck, man. You're a grown-ass man. He was 10 years older than me. He was 28 when I met him. I was 17, for fuck's sake. I'm like, there's the refrigerator. Figure it out, dude, you know? And I went, and I did what I needed to do for myself for once. And it stuck. And I was clean and sober for 8 years, and I worked a really good program. I continued therapy. I went to meetings. Narcotics Anonymous was my home. Of course, this was before the internet, so it was 1988 at that point. And I went back to school, and I got a decent job with the union, this food service company, and they had pretty good benefits. And you know, I paid for school. And I pay for my tuition. I went to school part time, and I worked full time. And the service was what got me, like that hooked me. You know, I learned, like, and just like it says in our fucking readings, you know, I learned how to be a productive, responsible member of society. And I gave back, and I still give back. And even when I picked up and I started to drink again, I continued to give back because that has been the thing that has meant the most to me. You know, it makes my life worth knowing that I have something to give to somebody. You know, when we go down that road and we're at the point where nothing matters anymore and we just want to die, somebody helps us out of that. We have an obligation to extend our hand and pull the next person up. We're, at least that's how I feel. And that gives my life meaning, and it gave my life meaning. I started to drink again in 1996. And I was working in the HIV field at that point, working with addicts who were HIV positive. Very fulfilling, meaningful work. And it's no like we end up, sometimes we end up where we end up for a reason. And for me, it was the substance use piece, the sexual risk, HIV, and the dying and death piece. Like I could connect with people, and I really did. And what they gave me was so much. Like I feel like I got as much as I gave. But I learned models of behavior change, and we worked with this model called Stages of Change, or TTM, the Trans-Theoretical Model of Change, where we stage people in different points in their life. And this one guy, he was from the Bronx. He was an injection drug user. Now he's probably in his late 30s or 40s. I'm trying to think back then. He was older than me. African American man, funny guy, very manipulative. And when other case managers, he was one of my clients, they'd say his name, they would start rolling their eyes. And it was like, what the fuck? You can't look at somebody and try to help them and looking down at your nose at the same time. You know what I'm saying? And he was the person that was never going to get it. And I just worked with him where he was at. I staged him in what he was doing right. I watered the seeds and not the fucking weeds. Because that's what society does. It waters the goddamn weeds. And that's why we feel shitty about ourselves, because nobody fosters the good things that we have in ourselves. I'm like, Omar, you didn't lose your apartment. You've had that for in and out of jail. The first time I met him was in jail. And he did. He got clean and sober. He left the area. And I had just gone through a terrible assault. I had my jaws wired shut from this other douchebag that I was in a relationship with. And the volunteer coordinator had seen him at the conference in Albany, the capital of New York, and at an AIDS conference, and he was clean and sober. And he's like, I couldn't have done what I did if it wasn't for Raven. And here I am in the staff meeting with my jaws wired shut, and I'm just sobbing. But it was like, that was the thing to me that made every fucking thing that I went through worth it. Knowing that I was able to give something to somebody and give them a piece of hope. And I think that's what we all want in recovery, is to hope that things are going to get better. Well, things got a lot worse for me. And they got better. So they kind of went sync, like they synced together. And I went to this training while I worked at the organization. It was called a sexuality attitude reassessment. The people had gone before me, because drug and alcohol, we had the worst funding. New York State Department of Health, AIDS Institute, they had all the good funding. So I went to the SAR, we called it sex camp, fondly called it sex camp. It was a week-long training on human sexuality from birth to death. And I'll tell you what, after that week, I went through so much, and I felt gypped as a human being that I didn't learn about this stuff growing up. And so that was my passion. And I met the guy that ran the sexuality program, doctoral program, master's and doctoral program. It had just moved from Penn to Widener, but now my Philadelphia. So I'm like, that's it. That's next. That's what I'm doing next. And I did. And I commuted 200 miles each way to do a master's and a PhD program. I did my dissertation research on sexual self-esteem with women in substance use treatment. Everything that I've done since then, I published a book. I'm writing the second edition to it now. It came out in 2012. But I got a tenure track teaching job. I lived in Illinois for 10 years. I worked in a taught in a Master of Health Sciences in addiction studies and behavioral health. And I gave back. And I spoke at conferences. I was a had a national presence, and I still do, just not to that degree. And I got divorced while I was out there. Moved with somebody from my log cabin in New York to Illinois, and I leased a farm out there for 10 years. And I did so many fucking awesome things, and but things got worse. And when I met Charles, we were, it was like, if you're gonna do any drug, what would it be? And it was coke. And that was the beginning of the end for me. It'd been over well over 30 years since I did any. And when we moved down here to Arkansas from Illinois, I was we weren't using anymore. I'm gonna finish up in the next minute here. And things, where they were going decent. There's my front yard. Here's my horses. We started a nonprofit to do equine assisted learning with the animals, with the horses. And then he died 4.5 years ago. I've been here 7 years, and that path after he died, I sold some property and I started making runs up north, and that took me down a path that, I don't want to say I never should have went there, but I ended up going there, and all I can say is thank God I didn't get pulled over because I didn't have a driver's license for almost 10 years. I'd have been fucked. And I got arrested last July, a fucking convicted felon. And it's like, okay, 62 years old, go Raven. But that brought me back. So you got to look at it that way, right? Get the good out of the bad. And anyways, there's more and there's always more, but I'm really glad I'm here. I know a lot of you, so I feel comfortable talking about some of this. And those of you that I don't know, it's like, oh, all right. So I've been coming back 2 years. I got 6 months now. I had 8 years, now I have 6 months. And it's like, well, it's been 18 months since I used the other shit, but whatever. Like the whole time thing fucks with me, but I'm here right now and I'm clean and I'm working towards what is next. And I don't know what that is, but it's got to be better than what was. Thanks for letting me share.